Jamie, this is really spooky because I interviewed you literally exactly 10 years ago here. It was the beginning of all was 2015.
At this table?
I think it was, actually, this table. That was in the background.
It's changed a bit. The trees have got bigger.
Oh, yeah. It's nice. It's a beautiful little park. I'm glad we're here again. It's a lovely day. I want to put your pundit hat on, or your historian hat, because in that last 10 years has been just globally a little bit of a roller coaster. So when I interviewed you, it was before Brexit, it was before all the political turmoil here, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and all that. Trump, it was before the pandemic, it was before the US defeat in Afghanistan, it was before the general rise of the far right, it was before the invasion of Ukraine, and it was before Israel's genocide. I mean, you kind of look at that and think the world has kind of gone to shit. Do you think it has?
I think it's much worse now than it was 10 years ago, because you've got greater poverty and inequality in this country, greater inequality globally, advancing environmental problems around the world, and now, which is possibly the most serious factor, is increasing rearmament all around the world. So you've got global arms spending last year, $2.4 trillion. This year, maybe $2.7, going up and up. Every country in the world is spending more on weapons. And I don't know if you remember it, last year we produced a book called The Monsters Angle of the Guns, which is about the profits of the arms trade. So we've got a factor that in as well. And what role are the Western countries playing to try and bring about world peace? What role is Britain playing? Well, it won't take long to answer that.
Well, we'll talk about that. The new party, which is yet to be named, we'll talk about that as well.
What have you got a suggestion?
I just keep it simple. The People's Party. What do you reckon? I don't know. Just pull it out there. Pull it out. Just, you know, I think in your own time. I don't mind what it's called. It's called Wibble, as long as it's got some good policies to address all the crises you're talking about. Why not before? I mean, the leadership, took the whip off you in 2020 and then clearly just went on and on and on about how they weren't going to let you in. Why not do it before the last election?
Well, I ceased to be leader of the Labour Party in April 2020. I was suspended in October 20 from party membership, reinstated 3 weeks later unanimously by the National Executive, and then the Parliamentary Labour Party withdrew the whip from me on a basis it was going to be taken away for 6 months. But it's been a long time.
A little bit longer than that, yeah.
It took longer. I obviously took a lot of soundings locally on what I should do. The Labour Party members wanted me to remain as their MP and to carry on fighting it. And so I took the view that I would fight it right up to the end. And if the Labour Party did what it eventually did, I would then run as an independent. And I did that. I also felt that winning here was very, very important. And I was under a lot of pressure from good comrades and good friends saying, look, Jeremy, form a new party now. This would be 21, 22.
Yeah.
And then you'll be ready for the election in what the guess would be 24, 25, obviously. I didn't do that for a number of reasons. One was, had I done that, I would have had to spend 2 years doing a lot of travelling around to get the new party going, to get it underway, to get it organised and so on, which would not have played well in the local community. And so I did what I've always done, represented the constituency and carried on doing that. And then when the election came in 24, we said, OK, you've done your worst. We'll let the people decide who the MP should be. This is after Starmer had put a resolution through the NEC saying I wasn't fit to be a public representative of the Labour Party, which was, I think, probably unprecedented in Labour Party history, that a former leader is deemed to be unfit to represent the party, a party I've been in since I was 16. And so we ran as an independent. We got amazing levels of support locally and outside. And what I noticed was the people who came to help, yes, many were friends and so on that I'd known for many years. A lot of local people came and helped. And I'd sort of didn't know them well, but knew them vaguely. I said, it's really nice to come and help. I've never seen you help in elections before. I said, no, I can never help the Labour Party, but I'll help you. So we brought in a new demographic. And then I figured that after we'd proved we could do it, and we won with a good vote, and the other independents were elected too. I didn't know them in advance, and it was kind of weird. The first day we were in Parliament, I invited them to come to my office. So they all came, and they sat around this big round table I've got in the office. I'm not sure they knew each other so well either. They said, this is like being called to the head teacher's study. So we sat down, poured out cups of tea all round, and had a chat. And we all come from different backgrounds, different political paths and so on. And we made a pact. We said, okay, we're going to work together. Where we agree, we'll work together. Where we don't agree, we'll say no more about it. Mm-hmm. We'll just park that and move on. And so it's worked. Yeah. And it's been actually a really pleasant experience. And the issue then was forming a new party. We discussed it for quite a while, ideas, structures and so on. And eventually we announced what is a week ago today. And as of this moment, which is 1 hour and 18 minutes short of when we announced, it's now just past 600,000 people registered.
Do you think that surpassed what you expected?
Oh, way above. Yeah, way above. I was thinking 200,000 to begin with, possibly. But this is now larger than the largest Labour Party membership ever, which was 600,000 when I stepped down.
We don't know how low the Labour membership's fallen to either, do they? Because they were the figures.
So that's a secret. That's a secret. Even the Communist Party of the Soviet Union used to publish membership figures.
They're slightly more democratic than this party, probably, the Labour Party.
In a very centralised way of doing things.
When you stood there, I mean, because I was, you know, out and about with you during that campaign, and...
Which campaign? The 15 leadership?
Or the general election in Islington North last year.
Last 24, yeah.
And it's interesting because actually people often don't realise that it's extremely hard to win as an independent. It's happened very rarely in a competitive general election since World War II. In fact, there's only three other times out where...
S.O. Davis.
In the 70s, yeah.
And there was... Kidderminster.
But that was in Canada. The party stood down to him. Where the party stands down, because again, there's Martin Hatton doesn't count either, because the Labour Party stood down to him.
Yeah. They certainly didn't stand out.
No, they certainly did not. They threw everything at you. And also, people also forget, because people think, well, you do have very loyal voters, been there all their lives, but there's a huge turnover of people all the time because of the private rent market. But what can you extrapolate from that? Because that a lot of pundits, some pundits would say, oh, well, you'll get 5%, you ended up getting a huge majority. So what was the lesson from that?
The lesson of that is two things. One is that... We have been very involved with everything to do with the community for the past 40 years in every aspect, community centres, housing estates, and so on, everything, all the time. And I've never neglected a constituency, never, ever. I spend my time doing stuff in the community, and I love it. I love the area. I know so many people there, which makes a difference. But it's not that alone. People felt that Labour were not offering them anything in the general election. They knew what I was offering. They knew what my beliefs are, principles are, and they responded to it, which I think was, if you look at it objectively, quite remarkable when they'd been told for years by the mainstream media that I was the devil incarnate. I was Satan on two legs. I've got horns coming out here. I've got a big moustache out here, and I'll probably carry a wand or something, you know. Sometimes people would come to the door who had very recently moved into the area, who didn't know me.
Yeah, because,
oh, Mr. Corbyn, we know all about you.
Right.
I'd say, so what do you know about me? They said, we've heard a lot of bad things about me. I said, well, let's discuss it. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go into a discussion with people. And it was lovely. And so we spent a lot of time, and also we made the campaign fun. Well, you remember it, you came.
It was
open-air rallies, always had music, poetry, entertainment. And what was great was, I was slightly nervous about holding canvassing rallies in the middle of a housing estate, because you think, Sunday afternoon, is it a good idea? And my team were very enthusiastic and very loud. I said, well, I'm kind of conscious of people's lives. And I said, are you really sure about this? They said, no, it'll be fine. I said, all right, I'll give it a go. So we went down to 6 Acres Estate, got the loudspeaker up, and a big crowd assembled. And then We had several speeches and a bit of music. And then I saw the windows opening all round. They were, oh, God, here it goes. Here it is, going to be complaints in a minute. Somebody's going, no. People came down and joined in. The rally was twice the size at the end it had been at the beginning. People wanted that style of politics. And that's what we're doing.
It's great.
It's called Your Party. I mean, sorry, it's not called Your Party. That's the holding name, basically. Just
Yourparty.uk.
Exactly. And there's been, I mean, a lot of the media response was just to sneer at that rather than engage with what it's seeking to do. Just explain, why Your Party? Why use that as the beginning?
Me and a few friends have been discussing various names. We've tried various things about Party of Peace, Party of Justice, People's Party, which you suggested, and a lot of other names. And I said, look, let's just have a holding name. And let's call it yourparty.uk. And then when we have our founding conference, which will be later this year, guessing November time, and we'll decide on a name. It may even be that name. But you know what? The idea you join a party without a name in order to choose the name is not a bad thing. It's democracy in action. And people are going to come up with some mad zany names. We could end up with sort of Boaty McParty or something, but
sign me up for that.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
I think, why not? I mean, you know, let's just, you know, I mean, it's a little bit 2018, probably. Labour originally was the Labour Representation Committee for several years before it became the Labour.
Well, the other idea I had was that we'd call it the Interim Committee for the Development of a Meaningful Understanding of Social Change and the Need for Justice and Inequality in a Peaceful and Sustainable
World.
So that'll fill up the whole ballot paper, wouldn't it? When you're ready, you think
that'll
catch up?
I think so. You wouldn't be able to miss it.
Back to you then.
So, I mean, just how's democracy going to work in this party? Because democracy, you've always talked about that, democratising the Labour Party. Now you've got a new party altogether, you can just start from scratch. What does it mean?
Good point. This is an interesting issue, an interesting conundrum. We've formed this party with the name it's got. I'm very conscious that there are lots of independent groups around the country, independent groups of councillors, independent party activists in many parts, all the way from Brighton to Barrow and all over. They're everywhere. There's also People's Assembly and many other groups around. Many of those have signed up for our party, but not all. We're not going to get involved in a turf war about who's numero uno in Birmingham, who's numero uno in Liverpool, and so on. No. We're going to work out a way of doing it so it will end up with being some kind of federal nature. And trade union involvement will be an important part of it. I'm not expecting national unions to sign up for it straight away, but I've had conversations with a lot of union leaders at the Durham Miners Gala and since, and we will therefore have that inclusive nature to it. The demographic, which is obviously broad, with 600,000 people in support, it's got to be very, very broad indeed. That has to be reflected in the structure. What I don't want is endless battles over who's controlling which committee, da-da-da-da. The way you keep a party together is by going forward on campaigning. Fundamental issues, peace, fundamental issue, social justice in this country, fundamental issue, environment sustainability, fundamental issue, protecting human rights and opposing the far right, because the other parties, all of them, are actually appeasing what Reform say. They join in this rhetoric, Ireland of strangers, etc., happening all over Europe. We're not doing that. We're the very opposite. I'm supporting a demonstration which is going on this weekend to defending people living in an asylum hotel. And you'll probably remember the first thing I did when I was elected leader of the Labour Party, against a lot of advice I received, was to go and speak at a Refugees of Welcome rally, because I wanted to put it out there. We're not joining in this tide of hate against people who've been victims of hate themselves.
You mentioned Labour there, echoing Enoch Powell and Nigel Farage. Is this Labour government worse than you would have expected?
Yes, much worse than I expected. I didn't have high expectations of it. The manifesto was insipid, weak, unmemorable. I ask anybody what was in the manifesto, they go, no more. They can very seldom name anything, but possibly they'll remember breakfast clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly, that's about it. I'm not saying breakfast clubs aren't valuable, they are, but you know, they're not the only thing. So what they've done is what? minor reforms in terms of rights of renters, slightly greater protection, but no rent control. Some improvement in workers' rights, but no sectoral bargaining, and so on, all the way through. And then rolling back against the environmental agenda, actively pursuing an increase in arms expenditure rather than promoting peace. I'm not pretending the world's simple or easy out there, but if you have an agenda to go to war, as Starmer and Healey appear to do, then what do? You spend more and more money on weapons, and Liz Kendall gets up in Parliament and says she wants to take $5 billion out of the DWP budget, which is earmarked for personal independence payments, and Starmer wants to put $13 billion more into the arms budget. What are we about as a country? Are we going to starve and impoverish people with disabilities in order to buy more planes from the USA? Because that's what it looks like.
I mean, speaking, the way you're speaking about this, I mean, because you were a Labour MP under Tony Blair, is this, do you think it's worse?
Well, Tony Blair and I were never close.
Yeah, I'd say like buddies. Close buddy. You were doing your camping trips together.
No, we didn't do any camping trips together. I don't think Tony Blair is kind of into Canada somehow.
Manchester with Berlusconi at the time, I think.
I think he was more into the Berlusconi style of holidays. The Blair government in 97 was a kind of interesting conundrum. I remember in, I think it was September 97, there was the vote on the single parent benefit. You remember it? And a number of us voted against it. And I remember going into the No lobby to vote. And as I got in there, Nick Brown is there, the chief whip. I said, Nick, this is remarkable, a chief whip rebelling against the government. He said, Jeremy, please. I'm not quite going that far, but I'm here to assure you that tomorrow there will still be a Labour Party, and tomorrow you will still be part of that Labour Party, because I respect what you're doing.
Papa? Really?
That was Chief Whip.
Interested.
Now, did he do that on his own, or did he do that with Blair's blessing? I don't know. But
they would have known his style.
They would have known the style. And so I thought that was interesting. Now, I'm not saying Blair loved us. He absolutely didn't. But until he got involved with Iraq and so on, the social justice program was an improvement. We got children's centres, we got Sure Start, we got Northern Ireland, which was fascinating. I mean, again, I had arguments with them about Northern Ireland. They were annoyed with me for meeting Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams in the run-up to the 97 election, and I said it's absolutely essential to do it. I've been meeting them for years, and I'll carry on meeting them. They said, we'd rather you didn't. I said, well, one day you'll be pleased I did. But they were prepared to engage. Now, Blair got totally off the wall when he got involved with Bush in Iraq, and I just remember the many meetings we had over the run-up to Iraq war. We had one meeting. There was about 10 Labour MPs around a table in the Prime Minister's room in the Commons, and Blair said, okay, I've got to go. He looked quite irritable and tired and quite bored with what we'd all been saying, because we'd all been saying much the same thing. He said, I'll take one more question. So I said, okay. He looked at me, fine, Jeremy, if you must. I said, yeah, I must, Tony. So I said, what's your question? I said, Tony, why are we doing this? Because it's the right thing to do.
Wow.
Then walked out.
Wow. Yeah, he really got that Masonic kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not engaging any more in this stuff. And after that, in the denial, and that's why I'm pushing the Gaza Inquiry Bill, which I put into Parliament, which is a Chilcot-style inquiry. Remember, Chilcot didn't come first.
No, there's also whitewashing.
Butler Inquiry and the Foreign Affairs Select Committee Inquiry. And then, so what I've done is put a Gaza Inquiry Bill to the House.
That's September.
Yeah, it's blocked by the government. Yeah. So we're doing an independent inquiry, 4th and 5th September, Church House, Westminster.
And that's to interrogate what British complicity actually is.
That's right.
But on that, Zoe Sultana, who you've launched this party with, she just says very clearly, very plainly, that Keir Starmer and David Lammy belong in The Hague. And the Genocide Convention...
Is what, wrong in the head?
No, belong in the Hague. Although, I mean, I don't want to speculate on that. No, but the Genocide Convention of 1948 prohibits five crimes. One of them is complicity in genocide.
Yes.
And it also imposes legal obligations of governments to prevent... Right.
I have raised this specific point in Parliament with Lammy and others who deny it. I've said to them, look, the ICJ has given its opinion that acts of a genocidal nature taking place in Gaza. I was at the ICJ to listen to it all.
These are a court of justice.
Absolutely fascinating. International Court of Justice. And I've raised this with them, with Healy and with Lammy. I said, look, the issue is, if you know genocidal acts are taking place, and you do know, and you are knowingly supplying the wherewithal to Israel to continue further acts, you yourself are complicit and open to prosecution. They deny it.
Very well.
And said it's not our legal advice. Well, that's an issue we will explore.
Well, the Conservative MP, Kit Malthouse, he's done actually a blinder of a job, I have to say. Fascinating. But he raised that. He said...
Kit Malthouse, no, not a natural mate.
No, I wouldn't imagine he would be, to be honest with you.
In a civilised way.
But he said to David Lammy that he could end up one day in the Hague. So, I mean, do you think that that's possible, that he could end up with prosecution?
It is extremely possible. And I remember going up to Kit after one of his contributions to the chamber, and I said, well done, well said,
comrade,
it must be a bit lonely doing this when he's surrounded by some pretty hawkish people. He said, well, coming from you, that's quite something.
But I mean, so Keir Starmer said that he tries to use Palestinian national statehood as a bargaining chip. He said that if Israel doesn't commit to a ceasefire, then he'll support the right of Palestine's national statehood. It doesn't make any sense, because he said that if Israel doesn't commit to a two-state solution, but then Britain would no longer support a Palestinian state. It doesn't make any sense. But what do you think about what he's saying now, instead of ending arms sales? And
it's absurd, and it's a travesty of any understanding of international law. I don't know whether Keir missed the lectures on international law or something. Maybe he skipped a few. But it's completely crazy. You either recognise Palestine or you don't. 146 countries have recognised Palestine. France says it's going to in September. Why not now? Don't know. And he says, we will recognise unless Israel agrees to a ceasefire. In other words, he's saying, you can continue the occupation, but you must stop the bombing, so we won't recognise Palestine. So it's leaving the Palestinian people once again in terrible limbo. So either you recognise or you don't. Right. Now, the House of Commons voted in more than 15 years.
Yeah, when Edgar Lebrun was Labour leader.
Yeah, on a private member's motion, voted non-binding motion to recognise the state of Palestine. So there is a record there for it, and I think that Starmer's confused position is going to be something else. Now, apparently, he told Labour MPs yesterday morning that there was going to be an unconditional recognition of Palestine. And then 4 hours later, he's met Donald Trump, and it's totally different.
With Israel's genocide, I think to myself, I want to phrase this properly, because I don't want to talk about the genocidal extermination of the Palestinian people as though it's some teachable lesson to the world. It's one of the abominations of our time. But, you know, it's changed me forever. It's changed other people forever. Do you think it has fundamentally changed politics in a way that isn't actually properly understood yet? I mean, we talk about the financial crash, the Iraq war, these all had long-term dramatic...
Brought out the human in a lot of people that didn't come out before. The previous genocides, you think Cambodia, you think Rwanda, you think Darfur, you think Second World War, all those genocides were not on live television in the way that this one is. Yes, they were in the case of particularly Rwanda, there was quite a lot of television coverage, but not to the extent we get now. We now get this live coverage. I don't know about you, I watch lots of different international channels, usually late at night, sort of Al Jazeera, France 24, and so on. Even I find it hard to look at it. When you see a mother with a baby, she's so emaciated and hungry and dehydrated, she can't create enough milk in herself to feed her baby. And she's got this wailing, crying baby who's clearly near to death. So you're watching live stream death. And what? Gaza is quite small. Probably 10 kilometres away.
In the size of East London, yeah.
There's water, yeah. There's milk, there's food, there's everything that baby needs. And it's been deliberately done by the state of Israel and by the IDF.
In plain sight. I mean, the difference, you mentioned Rwanda, we weren't arming the genocidal army at the time. Do you think, I mean, both the political and media elite, which is complicit in genocide, has just lost its legitimacy?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're complicit in genocide, as we now are as a country, we have supplied weapons knowing full well what's going to happen. And when I've asked about these surveillance flights over Gaza, there's an awful lot of them. What are they for? Because if they're supposed to be looking for the hostages, they haven't been very good at it. But besides, if hostages are being kept in tunnels somewhere, it's not very likely you'll see them from a plane. And so you ask yourself the question, what's this for? They refuse to say. And when I've said, is any of this information being passed on to the IDF? Are they actually surveillance rights to pro-point? They say, we're not saying what they're for. And so I said, okay, if that's the situation, will you therefore undertake that every piece of footage you've got, a film over Gaza, will be handed over to the ICC and the ICJ? They said, no, it's our information. Is it shared with Israel? And then Lemmy said that it is not being shared with the IDF for their purposes. So what is it for?
Yeah, it makes no sense, doesn't it? I mean, also because the IDF would have to allow them permission to do that. I mean,
we would have thought they'd shoot them down otherwise.
Well, they must, given the amount of flies, they must have huge amounts of evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity. So that itself is complicity, isn't it? They're not handing
over. Well, I would recommend that when the next inquiry takes place at either the ICC or ICJ or both, they subpoena Britain to come along with the evidence.
Yeah.
Britain has signed up fully to ICC and ICJ. USA is not, but...
So they've been prepared to torpedo what's called international law in order to protect Israel from accountability for genocide.
This is both a defeat and a victory for international law. It's a defeat because international law has clearly been breached. But the other side of it is that international law has at least given us the opening to do it, and the very brave decision by South Africa to do that. And I'm part of the Hague group, which we set up through Progressive International, which has just been joined by Turkey. So we now have 14 nations fully signed up to it and another 17 discussing it. So we might end up with a UN group of 40 or 50 nations signed up to it. And after that, things change.
Just the last thing. So Keir Starmer, you worked with him because he was in the Shadow Cabinet saying he was 100% loyal to Jeremy Corbyn and all the rest of it. What do you think makes him tick politically? I ask this because, you know, he's stood on a pack of lies, so we can lead the lane by. I can say it, even if you know. He lied through his teeth. And a recent book had his advisors briefing that Keir Starmer, he thinks he's driving the train, but we've put him in front of the District Light Railway, which, for those who don't know, is a driverless train. But that, I mean, they're openly briefing that
it's
this guy...
on a DLR train, is that
what you're saying? That's what they said. I'm just saying what they said. That's his own people. But I mean, that's interesting. They're saying he's just a front man, this guy. So what the hell... You had to work with him. Explain him. Explain him to me.
Well, I wish I could. I appointed him to the Shadow Cabinet. I thought he was very legally qualified. I mean, goodness, he'd been DPP, so you'd expect that. And that he would be across the details of the endless discussions about the withdrawal agreement, etc., etc., which he was, actually. We went to Brussels together a few times. We met Michel Barnier together. He didn't say a vast amount at those meetings, but he asked questions, but most of it was me and Barnier talking, and I was trying to get an agreement with Barnier of what we would do as a government in terms of trade and all those relations with Europe. What I found with Keir was that outside of the formal, detailed legal stuff, he had very little to say and very little opinions on anything. He's not somebody that would come here to this park with you and me and start chatting to that wonderful woman we're talking to who's been walking dogs. He wouldn't do that.
It's not Mr. Personable.
No, he's not. But then all politicians don't have to be Mr. Personable. But I do think you have to have some empathy and understanding of people's lives, what their hopes are, what their fears are, and what their wishes are. And we live in a country that is deeply divided getting worse. Poverty is getting worse. I've never known so many homeless, rough sleeping homeless people, never known so many hungry children, never known people so stressed or so in personal debt. And yet we're heading off in a direction of waving flags, spending more money on weapons and less on the needs of people. And we're doing that on a global scale. The arms race is the thing that is driving so much of it. And the rise of the far right all across Europe reflects that. Just finish on this. The rise of the far right. They've grown in Spain, Portugal, Italy, Germany, Austria, and so on. You know that. They set up this sort of wall of 10-15% of the electorate. The conservative parties all across Europe have moved to the right because they're fearful of losing support to the far right, leaving a big gap in the middle. Social Democrat parties, with some exceptions across Europe, have been disgraceful. What they've done is bought in to the rhetoric that refugees cause problems, bought into the rhetoric that somehow or other desperate people in Calais are a threat to our society, bought into that racist stuff about victims of war. And then the far right gained support because it's been legitimized by the whole political establishment. Your party.uk will never, ever go down that road. We'll be there this weekend opposing the rise of the far right, and we'll be there mobilizing people of all faiths, of all communities, of all languages to build a society that's fit for all of us. That's what we're about.
And do you think Labour's dead and forever? Do you think your former colleagues who've not signed up, would you want them? Do you think they'll come over?
It's amazing. When I was re-elected to Parliament last July, I walked into the Labour end of the tea room, and I now know what happened with the parting of the waves. There's a complete silence when I walked in, and I just walked through the swathes of new Labour MPs, and sort of, well, you know, somebody, he's got bubonic plague, by the way, don't go too near him. So I walked on through, and but now what I find is a lot of Labour MPs come and search me out in the library, so they look around like this. Jeremy, I think you're doing the right thing. And there's a lot of them that sort of say, well, fair play to you. You're doing the right thing. Good luck with the new party.
Interesting.
Are they going to come over tomorrow? No. Sure. But are they going to work with us? Yeah. So we are, therefore, a force in Parliament for social justice. And we work with Rachel Maskell, with John McDonnell and others, opposing the two-child benefit cap, etc.
Couple of final things. I mean, one is, Labour going to say, it's also Farage, the electoral system is what it is, and you like it or lump it, guys, you're going to have to vote for us, and this will split the vote, and Farage will become Prime Minister.
This is the Mandelson theory of politics, and it goes back a long way, that somehow or other, there's a huge block of working-class votes out there that will, however reluctantly, eventually be cajoled into voting Labour, because they've always done. I think a number of things have changed. That is no longer the case. People are less tribally loyal to any party or grouping than they've ever been in the past, more interested in the issues. And look at the election results where independents are running. And by and large, not all, but by and large, independents are a sort of cipher for a broadly peaceful left position. Not exclusively, but broadly speaking. And so I think things have changed. And the numbers that have signed up to us, I think, says it all. 600,000 is a pretty significant figure. That is more than twice the size of any other political party in the country.
Finally.
Already.
Finally. I just want to ask you finally. Zach Polanski is obviously the leader of the Greens. I think he'll win that leadership election. There's a slightly extraordinary discussion on LBC where he was on with Adrian Ramsey, who's one of the newly elected Green MPs, which he was asked if he liked Zach. And by the way, Zach is a very likeable, perfectly, really sweet guy, actually. And Adrian could not answer the question. So my question is, do you like Zach Polanski? And more to the point, would you work with the Green Party? And what's your attitude towards the Greens?
I do like Zach Polanski, and I think he's a very engaging, very personable and very honest guy. I mean, he and I have had differences in the past, but we've got over all that. And I personally get on with him. I've done meetings with him, anti-austerity meetings and so on. Would he work with them? Yes. On issues, generally, we'd agree on environmental issues. we'd agree on social justice issues. They're not a socialist organisation, and they seem to me into an eternal riven debate between trying to appeal to a sort of semi-conservative voting suburban electorate as opposed to a committed environmentally conscious electorate. So yes, we work with them in Parliament, and yes, we would cooperate, but we're not forming an alliance with them. They don't want to form an alliance with us, but we do recognise each other's positions, and I think we'll come to some good positions and good agreements in the future. Well, you know what's going to come out of all this? An end to the first-past-the-post electoral system.
Do you think that's what... Because that
will happen.
Do you think the next election will be a hung parliament, basically, and that the balance of power will buy enough smaller parties, and that will force a referendum on...
Labour's doing so badly that they're going to need PR, as are the other parties. So I think we'll get some form of proportional representation. The one I would favour would be a constituency system with an added list.
STV? To that. Is that STV?
You could do STV on a constituency basis, or you could do the current system on a constituency basis and then have a party add-on. But that, of course, reduces the role of completely independent independence, if you know what I mean. So this got to be worked out. But I do think some form of proportional representation will come. It is absurd that we have a government with the biggest majority ever on the basis of less votes than we got when I led the Labour Party in 2019.
And lowest turnout ever.
And several million less than we got in the 2017 election.
Yeah.
And that was the loveless landslide that Labour is now occupying all those seats.
Two-thirds of seats with one-third of the vote.
Yeah.
Very finally, if people haven't signed up yet, people are, you know, you've already got 600,000, but there's loads of people out there who are disillusioned, they're pissed off. But maybe they're not convinced yet. Maybe they're not sold. Maybe they're not really joiners, do you know what I mean? What would you say to them?
Listen out to what we're saying, listen out to what we're doing, see us in the community, see us working together, and see us being a genuine, welcoming open house to people to come along, put your ideas forward. We're going to be, yes, big, obviously, but we're also going to be the party of the creativity, music, culture, art, as well as economics that works for the people, not works against the people.
But Jeremy, in 10 years, maybe we'll do the interview here to see how it's all panned out.
That tree will be even bigger.
I know. Hopefully the world won't quite have gone to shit by then.
And you know what? I always think of Finsbury Park as the centre of my universe. And so we had a poetry evening at a community centre down the road last week. And I read my poem, Summer in Finsbury Park.
Oh. Well, check that out. Summer, it is a beautiful place to spend summer.
Yeah.
Cheers, Amy. Cheers, buddy.
Thanks, sorry.
Have fun too.